Welcome to the Green Alliance podcast. We are the charity and think tank that is all about achieving ambitious leadership for the environment. In this episode, we brought together a panel of experts to discuss racism in the environment sector.
Not until humanity begins to understand that they are part of nature and all other species, we're not going to go anywhere.
We have to do something, because if we don't, in the long term, the sector will be the much, much poorer for it.
What is the world that we want to see? What do we want to be able to have and to create and to give to the children in our lives for the future?
Following our event last year, in the wake of the murder of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter demonstrations, we wanted to hold this event to discuss what is needed for effective leadership and how to build momentum for change.
Without further ado, I will now introduce our fantastic panel. So we have Sarah Mukherjee, who is the CEO of IEMA, which is the Institute of Environmental Management and Assessment. We have Rebecca Munro, who is Executive Director, Fundraising and Communications at the RSPB. We have Annika Deva, who is the Partnerships and Comms Director for Enroll Yourself, where she leads ONIT, which is a peer support network helping women take climate action through their personal finances. And finally, we have Maxwell Ayamba, who is a PhD student in Black Studies in the Department of American and Canadian Studies at the University of Nottingham. Maxwell is also the founder and coordinator of the Sheffield Environmental Movement and co-founder of the 100 Black Men Walk for Health group. I will now turn to each of you for your opening question. So, Sarah, what is the role of leaders in the environment sector, and how can organisations best incorporate anti-racist strategies into their day-to-day work?
Obviously, as a person of colour myself, even in liberal institutions like the BBC, I have had more than my fair share of unconscious and conscious bias, active racism. And I think sometimes it's difficult for people who are not of colour to understand that just because we share the same set of liberal environmental values, it does not mean that that extends to other social values, liberal social values, for some sections of the workforce and environment and sustainability. And listening to those bright, brilliant women of colour who you had speaking last year, talking about experiences that I experienced 20 years before, it made me realise we are not changing, and we're not changing fast enough. And so we had a long think at IEMA about what we could do about this. And as Sean mentioned, we put together something we've called the Diverse Sustainability Initiative. Partly it's a toolkit put together by our members of colour, the things that they think will help work. There's a network for people of colour as well to share experience and speak truth to power, and a CEO's group to actually hopefully get some movement. It's very early days yet. I thought we'd have about 10 organisations. We've got 45. And so, you know, there are challenges of how we're going to run that effectively. But to Sean's point about recruitment, I think that that is a key for me. I have lots of conversations with recruiters who kind of, you know, screw up their eyes and look in the middle distance. They say, well, it's terribly difficult, you know, to get properly diverse candidate lists. Well, no, it really isn't if you can be bothered to do it. And so I'm hoping that we could use our collective power to say, we have a lot of jobs that we're looking for. We're looking for a lot of candidates, and we're looking to work with a recruiter who can actively invest in their networks to ensure we have people of colour coming through into the workplace. There's lots of things like paid internships. You can't expect people who are in low-waged or unwaged communities to pay for their own work effectively through an internship. Field work as well. You can't expect people to do their own field work because not everybody has the bank of mum and dad. So there's a very different way of looking at talent and how we promote it best into the sector. I think currently it's a disgrace the way that people of colour, neurodiversity, physical diversity is kind of excluded at the moment in the workplace, and white working class men and women as well.
Thank you, Sarah. And Annika, could you tell us about your experience of being both a leader and a woman of colour in the environment sector as part of leading ONIT and also being a community organiser?
Yeah, so as Ravina said before, I lead ONIT, which is a peer support network of women supporting women to take climate action through their personal finances. So things like moving your bank, your pension, your savings, your investments or starting to invest if you've never done that before. And in our pilots, we've had 140 women move £1.2 million, which is fantastic. And so we know that this next decade is crucial when it comes to climate action and really influencing those financial flows, which have so much power in climate justice. And so our ambition is to scale. And so in the next decade, we're aiming to galvanise a whole movement of women to move £1 billion by 2030. And so my big challenge at the moment over the next few months is to essentially resource us to scale over the next 3 years to move 10 million, to bring along 2,500 women. And I find myself every day in meetings with corporates to essentially create a sustainable revenue flow for this, and also applying to funders and to kind of apply for those grants and with some of those trusts and foundations. I am part of the COP26 Coalition West Midlands local group. And there what we're trying to do is really gather support and send people in whatever way, literally or virtually, to November to this really powerful, potentially really powerful gathering. So the reality of working in these worlds day to day is that I'm often the only person of colour in the room, or the only visible person of colour in the room, which really matters when you're on Zoom, you know? And people often think that you must be a student. That's what I often get asked. Are you a student? And I'm like, no, I've got too many grey hairs. And so, you know, this has real consequences when it comes to the work. I don't get taken as seriously, even by people who are really well-meaning. So, you know, we've got sexism, racism, an element of classism going on. And I have a lot of privilege in other areas. So I'm fortunate not to be affected by those things. But because of those things, there's always that doubt that means that actually clinching that client for a corporate partnership for this venture or getting that funding is always that bit harder. Microaggressions actually have health implications for people who are affected by oppression. So what do I feel is one of the cruxes of the problem? So if we're going to take a systemic lens, we know that there is never a single point of failure. And the moment we try and look for that silver bullet, we've missed it. We've missed the entire point that it's all systemic and interconnected and interwoven. But one of the points that I think we should be really trying to leverage is really understanding one of the basic tenets of any training on power and privilege, which is the four eyes of oppression: ideological, institutional, interpersonal, and internalized. Now, we so often focus on the interpersonal, you know, this lovely training that we brought in to make sure we don't say the wrong thing in a meeting. That's great and important. I'm not saying it isn't. But actually, if we ignore the other aspects of oppression, then we are missing everything. We're missing the actual deep underlying structures that inform everything that we're doing. The ideological position in this country and in many countries around the world, the ideology upon which our foundations are, is an ideology of white supremacy. And if we don't understand that, and if we don't understand how white supremacy was constructed, then everything we do is just hitting at the surface. We're trying to work downstream when actually upstream is where we can create the most powerful change. Go and read Angela Saini's book, Superior. If we don't understand how race is a social construct and racism is very real at the same time, then we're missing everything and we're not understanding anything. What can we do about this? Actually, yes, it's about learning and it's about action. And this learning and action needs to be embedded within everything that we do, embodied, so it needs to actually move our souls and not just hit our brain cells. It needs to be expressed. We need to be able to share and to talk and to discuss together how we're actually going to move towards change and towards, you know, changing that picture so that someone in 20 years' time is not coming along and still having this same conversation.
Rebecca, Rebecca, could you just tell us a little bit about RSPB's work in this area? And what are some of the really important things you've learned from this work?
I see my role really as a kind of guide to a practical example of how an organisation like the RSPB, a great big Victorian charity with all of the institutional challenges and institutional racism that Anika was just talking about then, very much inherent in our, you know, our day-to-day work, our organisational life. So we've been on our equality, diversity and inclusion and social justice journey for the last 5 years now. We've made some progress, but towards the end of last year, we really realised that that what we were doing was insufficient to the need. So we kind of reset and rebooted what we called our Equality, Diversity, Inclusion and Social Justice Programme. And that involved us recognising that we didn't have the capabilities internally to be able to do this. So we brought on the wonderful EDI consulting company Full Colour, who's actually also doing the Wildlife and Countryside Link work at the moment. So helping the sector as a whole. And we set them on a course to do a really ambitious review of, you know, what was holding us back as an organisation in terms of being more equal, diverse and inclusive, and what were the kind of recommendations about how we needed to take this forward. I have to say, as a senior leader in the organisation, it made for some really uncomfortable reading. We all reacted in different ways, some of us really emotionally, some of us with anger, some of us with disbelief. You know, it's things like a lack of meaningful leadership on equality, diversity, inclusion. Things like, you know, no sense of why EDI mattered to us as an organisation or to our mission. And what we tended to do as well was kind of homogenise equality, diversity, inclusion into EDI, as opposed to, you know, what is equality? What is inclusion? What are the different types of diversity? So, yeah, so that's just a real high level flavour of what we called that diagnosis report and recommendations. And since then, we've really been working hard to take that report and to make that a reality to, you know, staff and volunteers. There's 13,000 volunteers at the RSPB, and they are equally underdiverse as the staff makeup of the RSPB. And what I really wanted to share to you with you today was one key lesson that I think I certainly have learned as a senior leader, and that is we need to, as an environment sector, answer the question, why EDI matters to our mission. The thing that I think we're lacking as a sector, and certainly I can speak for the RSPB, is an answer to the question of why EDI matters to protecting and restoring the environment and tackling climate change. And that might feel slightly uncomfortable for us as a sector to say, are we actually appropriating social justice and human rights for our environmental outcomes? You know, it might feel uncomfortable to actually say, you know, do environmental outcomes, can they sit equally alongside, you know, human rights and social justice outcomes? But my view of that, and actually it was a very clear recommendation in our diagnosis report, is that for us to play a part as a sector, for us to make a contribution to dismantling the institutional racism, not only in our sector, but more broadly, that we actually need to bring that issue closer to home. We need to relate it to what we're trying to do as organisations. So the RSPB is going through the process at the moment of trying to answer that question. To answer that question exposes the inherent racism, kind of the colonialist white privilege that is part of our sector. And I also think that without the intersectionality of that environment social justice piece, we all come to work to make a difference to the environment. So unless we connect those things together, we're never going to make that progress. And I think that the charity sector overall does, you know, potentially struggle emotionally as well as intellectually with this, maybe more so than our commercial counterparts, in that we are good people doing good things. So to ask those hard questions that sometimes we might be good people, but we're still not doing good things. So my one lesson to share with you today, and hopefully I can share more lessons throughout the day, but certainly my one lesson is that we really, as a sector, if we are going to gather momentum behind dismantling the racism in our sector more broadly, we must answer the question of why equality, diversity, inclusion and social justice matters to our work as environmentalists.
Great. And finally, last but not least, Maxwell, I wanted to ask you, thinking about access to and participation in the UK's natural environment, what, if anything at all, has really changed over time in this area, and what barriers still need to be understood and tackled?
First of all, I just want you to know that I'm an ecocentrist. And if you know what an ecocentrist means, I'm just completely linked to nature anyway. Just back to your question, I would like to begin by arguing that the discourse around race, ecology, and environmental justice in the UK until recently has received little attention as compared to the US. In fact, it took the COVID-19 pandemic's disproportionate impact on Black and ethnic minority communities, as well as the reemergence of the Black Lives Matter movement, for environmental organizations and government to begin to reconsider failings to promote diversity and inclusion in the natural world. In fact, the first real attempt by a UK government to address environmental injustice was the setting up the Black Environment Network, BEN, in the 1980s, which was led by Professor Julian Agyeman and Dr. Ingrid Pollard. It was meant to challenge the normative whiteness in nature, especially in the English rural countryside space, where it is even more blatant. This subsequently led to successive UK governments launching several diversity reviews. In fact, the first one started in 2003, culminating in the Julian Glover Review in 2019, which Sarah was involved. In fact, the most notable review was in 2005 by the Countryside Agency, now Natural England, capturing richness, What About Us? The findings noted that the official efforts to tackle access and participation in the natural environment is piecemeal. It lacked long-term thinking, leaving many grassroots projects, groups, and individuals working to increase representation unable to achieve this objective. So besides lack of government commitment, no platform for BME organizations to have their voices heard or receive sustainable funding. These same issues were identified in the Global Review of the Designated Landscapes, which featured the most recent in-depth evaluation of the lack of diversity in the countryside. In fact, there was this quote I'm going to take from it. It's, quote, "We are all paying for national landscapes through our taxes, and yet sometimes on our visits, it has felt as if national parks or areas for astounding natural beauties are an exclusive, mainly white, mainly middle-class club with rules only members understand and might little done to encourage first-time visitors." In fact, studies have continued to show that access to and participation in the natural environment, though it's good for the nation's health and well-being, it remains unequal. The CPRE noted that available statistics indicate inequalities to countryside, though connected to income, age, and disability, is particularly severe when it comes to race. For example, a Natural England research has shown that 1% of visitors to national parks are by people of Black and ethnic minority background, with 20% of children from these communities less likely to visit the countryside. A 2017 report by the think tank, the Policy Exchange, using ONS data, ranked the environmental profession as the second least diverse profession in the UK, with just 3.1% of staff from minoritized groups, only second to farming. And though these issues can be framed around the intersectionality of race, culture, economics, and geography, however, the problem is with the UK's preservation movement, which centers on the notion of class. As the late David Hay noted in his study of the 1932 mass trespass, the preservation and access movements are somewhat of a self-valoration and mythology. Systemic racism exists within the interplay of the attitudes of some environmental organizations and their staff, within the negative narratives and messaging about Black and ethnic minority people and their relationship with nature, and within the impositions of conservation models, which are all Eurocentric. Disparities in access and rights to nature, nature-related and health disparities, and environmental justice continues to persist in the UK environmental sector. Lack of funding for ethnic minority environmental charities and organizations, which impedes voices of marginalized groups to be heard. Funders tend to prioritize white-led environmental organizations who then approach Black and ethnic minority groups to access specialisms, often with the expectation that they should work for free, characterized by exploitation and the lack of respect for their experience, knowledge, and approaches of Black and ethnic minority practitioners or professionals in the environmental field. So what needs to be changed? There needs to be an acknowledgement of the historical and current injustices within the environmental field, which are rooted in the history of eugenics and white supremacy. Two, ending and repairing the damage of racism within the environmental field will require removal of structures and systems which allow gatekeeping exclusively by people who benefit and perpetuate from white supremacy. Eradicate racism in the environmental field will require the attitudes, conduct, messaging, policies, images, resourcing approaches involved in the environmental field. Those working in the environmental field will need to re-educate themselves through use of critical race theory to understand racism, prejudices, and stereotypes behind the conservation movement by holding honest conversations to reframe the narratives of these beliefs and attitudes which have existed for a long, long time. And finally, the exclusively white middle class staffing and management structures in the environmental field creates a green insiders club, leading to the internal perception developed historically that they are the true custodians of the natural world. And this all needs to change. If these don't change, we're not going to get anywhere, and the Anthropocene is on the horizon.
I think that's given us a lot to think about, so thank you so much. Can any of you think of any kind of anti-racist strategies or initiatives which have already come about that have worked and led to tangible change and really kind of making progress in centering issues of racial and social justice, which a lot of us are trying to grapple with? Has anyone seen some really fantastic examples of that?
Well, do you know what? I mean, I don't wish to have a downer on this, but one of the reasons that we started the Diverse Sustainability Initiative was that, you know, we were really struggling to see other examples of where people were genuinely being listened to in the environment and sustainability sector. Maxwell and I have had many conversations about this. In fact, the quote that he took out of the Glover Review was one of the ones I put in, because, you know, most people of colour and people from low and unwaged families do not have the finances to do all this exciting voluntary work that gets a lot of people their jobs in the environment sector. There's almost a kind of dirty secret that you actually probably have to have someone supporting you in order to have a career, because it's, you know, people don't get paid particularly well. And if you're a bright, brilliant graduate of colour, there's a real imperative to make sure you can clothe and feed and get a roof over your head without someone available in the background or private money to be able to support that. We're struggling to see where there's really a lot of difference being made at the moment in the sector. There's a lot of talk, and I absolutely accept that we are one of the people who are talking about it, but we hope to translate this into action. Start paying your interns, which we're going to be doing, you know, and I know that some organisations are. Stop asking for field work. Stop recruiting people because you know them or you know their families or their parents. Make your employment transparent and listen to people with respect.
Thank you, Sarah. And Annika, I wanted to come to you to not only if you've got any examples, but also from your experience with funders, which I think is really interesting. Have you seen any kind of good examples of funders using the power that they have to really make change?
Yeah, this idea of resourcing the work, I think, is so important. And the other kind of aspect of that is this idea of imagination and space to imagine possibility and space to develop the kind of vision and dream of what it is that we actually want rather than what we're fighting against. Because it's really easy to get stuck there because there is so much that we are fighting against. When it comes to resourcing racial justice is a coalition of POC, different organisations, but also funders, actually. Some really big funders have got behind resourcing racial justice. And then the other kind of example that I want to raise up has kind of two parts. Some of you may have been to the National Lottery Community Fund's Infrastructuring Imagination event organised by Cassie Robinson and a bunch of other fab folks. That was really powerful, and it was just showing us that actually we have got to put the infrastructure underneath this work if we want it to be long-term, sustainable, achievable, and actually something that will create impact. And an example that was shared at that event and that I've actually been part of is a kind of micro-funding programme from Civic Square, who are an organisation in Birmingham who are doing place-based system change in the heart of Ladywood in Birmingham. And they launched something last year called the Dream Fund as part of the Department of Dreams. And these were micro-grants of £1,000 that could be used by individuals to create a dream, to go away and dream. And the application was one of the simplest applications I've ever filled in my life. It had like 7 questions. You could reply by voice note or by video if you wanted to. And the outcomes that they expected were so based in trust. It was like, it's up to you. You can write something. You can create something. You can go away and use the money to just think. I mean, I've never been paid to think before. And just that level of trust is just, I haven't seen it anywhere else. And it was beautiful. And it really unlocked me to be able to create the vision of what is the space that I want to be part of when it comes to grassroots organising. And as a result of that fund, I'm going on a walk from Birmingham to Bristol in a couple of weeks and really continuing to do some of that imagining about what is the world that we want to see. What do we want to be able to have and to create and to give to the children in our lives for the future?
And Maxwell, I just wanted to come to you. When we're thinking about anti-racist strategies, what do you think are just a few really important things organisations should be thinking about at the start of those anti-racist strategies? You touched on some really important issues like colonialism, like white supremacy.
Well, thanks, Ravina. I suppose it's quite ironical where we talk about biodiversity and yet we don't talk about human diversity. And that's what nature is all about. Nature is everyone. And we are part of nature. So for some people to think they are superior to other people or other species, and therefore they are the custodians of nature, is exactly the crisis we are facing now with the climate change and the Anthropocene. And so before we talk about anti-racist policies, we have to talk about critical whiteness. We have to talk about deconstructing racism. Without tackling critical whiteness and deconstructing racism, we're not going to get anywhere. You could have all the policies written, but it has to come from the heart. Not until humanity begins to understand that they are part of nature and all other species, and that we are just passing through this life, and to leave this world a better place for those to come. We're not going to go anywhere. So to me, you could have all the anti-racist policies there, but what's important really is the heart, change in the heart. For a human being to look another human being in the eyes and find out that we are all from the same race, and that race is a tool for oppression. You know, it's a metaphor for oppression of other people. And so the only way anti-racist policies can work is people have to look at themselves and see who they are and look deep down in their hearts and to think about changing the way they see other things, other human beings, as being inferior or as being less, to contribute to the whole environmental crisis that we are currently facing in the world.
Diversity of thought is absolutely crucial for the biggest issue facing humankind. And anything that stops that diversity of thought is not only bordering on the criminal, but it's from a purely pragmatic point of view, you are not going to get the solutions to the massive issues that you face unless you have as many people, as many different ways of thinking as possible. But there is always a danger, and I admit I have been part of this, you know, being a person of colour in the workplace in the 90s, you could try and squash yourself into a kind of the box that you're expected to behave as, and that often means kind of editing your personality. And I think it's a really good point. There is a danger that we all become so edited in order to achieve the way up the ladder that you stop having that diversity. So that's sometimes very challenging, particularly, again, back to this interview process. You know, if you're interviewing people who think in a very different way to you, you have to think about how that will absolutely add something to your organisation. The more ways you have of thinking, the better.
Annika, I'm going to come to you, just if that's something that you've been thinking about as you've got this really incredible plan going forward, trying to include that diversity of thought as well as, you know, diversity of kind of race and other elements.
There's this thing about not being afraid. There's this beautiful Audre Lorde quote: when we speak, we are afraid our words will not be heard nor welcomed. But when we are silent, we are still afraid. So it is better to speak. And that's the point, right? Like, if we're just going to not speak out of fear, then we're never going to change anything. What is it that we're afraid of? What are the invisible fears that we're too afraid to talk about? And let's talk about them. Let's surface them. On the other hand, I would also say that we need to be kinder to each other, and we need to allow for mistakes to be made. And Adrienne Marie Brown, who, if you haven't read any Adrienne Marie Brown, please just go and buy her book now or borrow it from your library. She has written a book that's called We Will Not Cancel Us. And this cancel culture is really pervasive. We need to be really careful. Cancelling is a tactic. When we're thinking about strategic campaigning, cancelling is a tactic. And sometimes this public shaming is really important, right? When we're working with a corporate power who have so much power and have never listened to us ever before, That is a tactic and we should use it. But when we're talking about each other, when we're talking about allies and friends, we should be trying to have these conversations with each other and actually change things together rather than, you know, get involved in this public shaming and this Twitter outcry. And that's not to say that we shouldn't be honest about what's actually happening. It's not to say we shouldn't be allowed to talk about it, but we should do it together first rather than instantly go to these kind of platforms where we're so disconnected. None of us are immune, so we have to stay humble in that we'll always make mistakes. And there is hope. There is something we can do. There is change that can happen when we're honest about actually what's happening and what needs to change.
Thank you for listening to this Green Alliance podcast. Keep checking in as we will continue to bring you specialist interviews and highlights from our events here on the podcast. You can subscribe to the Green Alliance podcast on your favourite podcast app, and you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter at Green Alliance UK.